loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, Donald Trump is now claiming he will send 15,000 U.S. troops to the U.S.-Mexican border. That's triple the number he announced last week, even though the migrant caravan continues to get smaller each passing day. 15,000 U.S. troops is nearly triple the number of U.S. troops in Iraq. And then we continue our weekly series called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the judges, and the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, more than 1,000 Google employees and contractors briefly walked off the job yesterday in Europe and Asia amid complaints of racism, sexism, and abuse of executive authority in the workplace. More walkouts are scheduled today. Google's chief executive said in a statement that the company will carefully weigh its employees' demands and respond appropriately. Next, the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, issued a report yesterday showing that the Afghan government controls less territory than it has at any time since the U.S. invasion. SIGAR said that the government of Ashraf Ghani controls only 55.5% of Afghanistan after 17 years of U.S. military aid and support. Then, Human Rights Watch, the U.S.-based human rights organization, released a study yesterday based on interviews with more than 100 North Korean defectors now in South Korea, saying that North Korean government officials routinely commit sexual violence against women with impunity. The allegation is shocking, but critics say this is just another smear job to derail steps toward peace in Korea. And then the Bank of England this morning warned of an economic catastrophe if the UK leaves the European Union without a Brexit deal. Bank Governor Mark Carney said that, absent an agreement, the UK should expect gridlock in its ports and airports, inflation, and a collapse in the value of the pound. This comes as police open a criminal probe into pro-Brexit campaign donor Aaron Banks, who has been the target of conspiracy theories relating to his business interests in Russia. And finally, Representative Steve King, a Republican of Iowa, is one of the most conservative and anti-immigrant members of the House of Representatives. He calls himself a nationalist. Many of his detractors call him a bigot, a racist, and a white nationalist. King made a controversial tweet a few days ago and instantly moved his safe Republican seat to a toss-up. Is there a limit to xenophobia, even for so-called conservative Republicans? And in other headlines, Robert Bowers entered a not guilty plea in court today after being charged with 44 felony counts related to the massacre of 11 worshippers at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. Bowers expressed virulent anti-Semitic and fascist views on the social media platform Gab and made a post about his intentions just before the attack. Bowers could face the death penalty. The United Nations General Assembly completed its annual vote condemning the U.S. blockade of Cuba by a massive margin of 189-2. The two countries that didn't support the condemnation were the United States and Israel, a vote identical to every year but one that the resolution has been voted on since 1992. Oprah Winfrey denied having presidential ambitions today, saying, quote, "I don't want to run. I'm not trying to test any waters. I don't want to go in those waters," unquote. Winfrey made the comments while campaigning for Stacey Abrams, the Democratic nominee for governor of Georgia. The Turkish Defense Ministry announced today that joint patrols by the U.S. and Turkish militaries have begun in the Syrian city of Manbij. The city was under the control of the Kurdish YPG militia, a principal enemy of the Turkish government but a main ally of the United States. Turkey had threatened to attack the city, but an agreement that involved the joint patrols averted the offensive. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the caravan coming from Central America towards the United States and its intersection with the U.S. midterm elections. With less than a week left before the midterm elections, Donald Trump has announced that he would be sending up to 15,000 U.S. soldiers and Marines to the U.S.-Mexico border. Meanwhile, Republicans released an overtly racist campaign ad yesterday, showing an undocumented immigrant who was convicted of killing two police officers, saying with a smile that he would soon escape and kill more people And then the ad blames the Democratic Party for the deaths of the victims. We're joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez. He is the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. And we're joined from Tucson, Arizona by Isabel Garcia, co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Isabel, Juan Jose, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me.
Let's start with you, Isabel. It seems with each passing day, even though the caravan seems to have gotten smaller numerically, the flames of heated rhetoric are fanned over and over again, a more incendiary kind of anti-immigrant fire as a device, simply as a device, as a tool for the midterm congressional elections organized by Donald Trump and the Republican Party. Anyway, let's briefly get your take and Juan Jose's take, and then we have a bunch of other questions we want to pose to both of you.
Yes, it's very clear that the Trump administration is just using this to stoke his base of racists. It's a blatant appeal to racial division and to hate. Again, I'll say it a million times. Migration is still lower today than when I graduated from high school here in Tucson in 1971. The fact that he has chosen to create this scandal when really the humanitarian crisis is real. The people that are fleeing should be met with blankets and water and food and hospitality. I mean, in our country of millions and millions that we cannot see fit to bring in children and mothers, and that we're sending 15,000 troops to the border, I'm just outraged. I mean, it's worse than the Willie Horton of our time, because this is clearly to stoke the racist flames. And as I've told you before many a time, it's easy to stoke racism in this country because of fear, and because of the lies that we have been fed historically. I mean, if people knew history and if people knew what we're even doing today in Honduras, what we did yesterday and last year in Honduras, then people wouldn't be wondering why Hondureños are marching north for their life.
John, you want to jump in? Go ahead.
I did want to jump in first to agree with both of our guests here. I also wanted to make a quick comment on this disgusting racist advertisement that Donald Trump tweeted yesterday. You know, it was shocking when it first came out. It was shocking in how blatantly racist it was. With that said, now we've had 24 hours where people have had a chance to actually take a look at it. And as it turns out, this man was actually deported by a Democratic president. He snuck back in while Donald Trump was president. He lived in a Republican-dominated state, Utah, and killed two policemen in Utah. So how in the world Donald Trump and the Republicans think that they can successfully use a racist attack against Democrats for a mistake that they made, I think is going to fall flat, and it's going to bite them because, first of all, it's a lie.
Is it coming out, though? Is it being publicized?
Not people are just now starting to talk about it.
Because it seems to me, Juan Jose, I hear John completely. I mean, the facts always they go to the back of the line when it comes to what's politicking. But nonetheless, here we have the President of the United States deliberately, as Isabel said, generating hatred and hostility as an election ploy. I just wonder, though, now that it's gone from 1,200 troops to 5,000 troops and now 15,000 troops, which is, you know, there's only 6,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, and the caravan's getting smaller. One, is Donald Trump overreaching here in terms of this racist ploy? Is it possible he's overreaching? And two, let's go into a little bit why the caravan has, in fact, gotten smaller recently.
Okay, well, let's start at the beginning. You know, the situation that we have today at the border because of this latest political ploy by Donald Trump and the Republican right wing is really explosive. Because we're not just talking about the potential of having 15,000 members of the U.S. Armed Forces collaborating with an additional 20,000 Border Patrol agents who are now stationed at the border. And there's also been reports that many right-wing armed militias are marching towards the border to confront, collaborate, and prevent immigrants from coming into the country. And so that's an explosive situation there. Now, compare the 40,000 or so armed individuals, most of them members of the U.S. Federal government, who are going to be charged with patrolling the border and preventing immigrants from coming in. Compare that to the original 7,000 people that were marching in desperation all the way from Central America through Mexico. Now, that caravan, which at its height was 7,000, has now fallen to about 3,000. Those are the latest reports that I'm getting, anywhere from 2,500 to 3,000, and they're presently in the state of Oaxaca marching towards Mexico City. So there's still a long ways from getting to the border in the next 5 years, in the next 5 days, right when we're going to be celebrating the midterm congressional elections and others. So what I think that we have here is clearly overreaching by President Donald Trump. And when you put that in context of the anti-right-wing policies that both Democrats and Republicans, have been pursuing for a long time, and that's created the economic and political disaster that are Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, which is now forcing people to come en masse to the U.S., even though it's not the problem that it's made to seem, because I don't think we have a national emergency. As Isabel mentioned, this is a small drop in the bucket in terms of how many people are coming to the States.
Let me bring Isabel back in. Isabel, why is, factually speaking, why is the caravan went from a small number, hundreds, then maybe 1,000, then it grew as social media started to talk about it, 7,000, and now it's dropped back down to, a couple thousand fewer. What's the reason for that?
Well, the drop, of course, is because, imagine engaging in that journey. I mean, people want to leave and want to survive. When you see on Facebook, when you see on social media that there is a group traveling north, of course, and it's happened annually for the most part. It's happened in the past. It's not the first time. And people come together because they know they can survive better if they're in numbers. Now, of course, we expect it to dwindle off because Mexico initially, and it's giving mixed signals, initially really was repressive and continues to be very limiting in what they're doing. But people can only take so much. And so, you can march and march. But I think what's really important is what Juan Jose said right now. And people need to listen to this, that this is forced migration. How dare you call them invaders? This is forced migration, and in large part forced by U.S. policy.
And Juan Jose, you had mentioned also some people, it is a huge trek. It's 1,000+ miles to walk, mainly walking. Some people, I guess, are riding in trucks or to some extent, but it's mainly people walking. Why are some people going home to Honduras? And we also heard that in Chiapas, in the southern state of Chiapas of Mexico, that the Mexican government was giving an incentive of sorts by offering people employment, and quite a number actually did that. Anyway, talk about that.
Well, let's make something clear. The Mexican people have welcomed this immigrant caravan in spite of the mixed signals of the Mexican government, which is true. First they try to stop people from coming into Mexico and making their way to the U.S. as they had expressed that to be their desire. And then because of the international outcry at the way the Mexican government was behaving in violation of its international commitments in immigration policy. They sort of like backed off and allowed people to come in, but that certainly created a lot of strain amongst the immigrants because one thing is to talk about the 7,000 people that eventually the caravan grew to, but let us not forget that within those 7,000, there were over 1,200, 1,500 children that were traveling with this caravan. And just imagine having to contend with federal Mexican forces all around you that, although not directly confronting you some of the way, they're all around you. And they're trying to force you into detention centers or refugee centers, as they call them, which many immigrants imagine them to be nothing more than, prisons or centers where, they're not going to be able to escape from as promised. And eventually those can become centers from which they would be turned back. All these pressures combined and others that I haven't mentioned have already forced roughly 2,000 members of the 7,000 member caravan to decide on their own, but obviously under duress, to go back to Honduras or to Guatemala or some to El Salvador. And those pressures are still on as we speak. So expect the caravan to get smaller before it gets any bigger than it is right now.
Isabel, I wanted to change topics here and ask you about President Trump's threat to issue an executive order essentially doing away with birthright citizenship, something that's been a staple in this country since the middle of the 19th century. Many constitutional scholars have come out in the last couple of days saying, just very simply, he can't do that. Do you see this as a political ploy? Do you think this is a serious thing he's intending to try? How do you think this will play out?
Number one, it's a ploy. Number one, he's a transactional human being, and he knows this is what really riles his base. And if he found enough traction in Congress and everything, would he make it real? Absolutely. Absolutely. This guy's waiting for all of this to become real. But this goes to show you how really extreme we have gone, and we have permitted, because we permitted Trump, even before he was elected, we've permitted so much to happen in the area of immigration under Democratic administrations and such, that we handed over to this administration the ability, well, even to have that soapbox to say that, chain migration and all these horrible words that he uses can be allowed in society, really is, that's where the hurt is, the children that hear this and everybody who listens to this. I mean, there's medical professionals that are swayed by this, that have been heard, nurses that have been heard, oh yeah, the illegals shouldn't be here. So this is very, very serious. Whether he attempts an executive order or not, he's committed a lot of damage to our community.
Juan Jose, let me toss the same question to you. The 14th Amendment was passed in 1868. The reason for the passage was, before then, enslaved African people, who constituted a vast part of the population, were not citizens. They were not even considered human beings. They were property. And the 14th Amendment said, look, there's not going to be two classes, citizens and property, people and non-people. There's going to be people. And anyone born in the United States, by virtue of having been born here, would be a citizen regardless of race. In other words, it was a declaration that all people are free people. Finally. After all those decades, after the Declaration of Independence proclaimed that people had inalienable rights and the rights of man, so to speak, were enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. Finally, the 14th Amendment said, in fact, all people born in the United States are citizens. Now, you might make the argument, as the right wing is starting to do with the Heritage Foundation or parts of the Federalist Society, that diplomats, the children, the diplomats who have children born in the United States, those diplomats' children are not United States citizens, but nor are they subject to U.S. laws. They're immunized from U.S. laws because they're considered to be outside the domain, the jurisdiction of the United States. That's the only thing that the right wing can really point to, are those kind of arguments. And of course, if you make that the case, if not being a citizen means that you're not subject to U.S. laws, then of course the right wing would have to reconsider this position about abolishing the 14th Amendment. But they're not going to do that. I want to ask you, I mean, this is Donald Trump reversing, in a way, attempting to reverse the verdict of the Civil War and the end of slavery. In other words, it's not just about immigrants. This has importance, significance, and historical significance for all people in the United States, but in particular, people who were considered, quote, minority communities in the past.
Absolutely, Brian. And I think that here, thanks to the demagoguery that is being used by President Donald Trump against immigrants, we now can begin to understand in very explicit ways what he meant or what he means when he continues to declare that he fully intends to make America great again. You know, meaning the way you just explained it, the way you just broke it down, that he wants to take us back to pre-Civil War times, pre-1868, when a significant portion of the U.S. population was deemed property, meaning African Americans, and even women to a large extent who did not have the right to vote, etc. And so when the 14th Amendment was added to the Constitution by Congress, it meant that now we only have people and that everybody's a free person in this country within the boundaries of what freedom means in America to this very day. And that's that. And that seemed to be settled law or a settled right for the longest time, post-1868. What Donald Trump is doing is not just attacking immigrants when he talks about taking birthright citizenship away from children born to an undocumented woman, to an undocumented mother, but he basically is beginning to get into the rearm of once again reclassifying entire ethnic populations in the states as less citizens than full citizens of the United States, which it appears that means in the mind of Donald Trump and his ilk, white men and perhaps women, at this late stage of the game.
He wants to erase us.
Go ahead, Isabel.
He would like to erase us, right? He just did this leak the policy about erasing transgender people. Now he wants to take citizenship away. And I agree. Where is Donald Trump's ire and anger with all of these white mass murders? U.S. citizen, white male mass murderers. Where is he? I'm trying to see where he's going to come out on any of these murders. He hasn't mentioned the murder of the African-American grandfather and the grandmother. I mean, this is exactly what he's doing, just fomenting to the racism and going back, like Juan Jose says, to be the default, that white male is the default and you're all lesser than, and this is what you need to strive for.
That's Isabel Garcia, and Isabel was referring to the racist killing at the Kroger grocery in Kentucky of the two elderly African-American people.
And the many killings this past 2 years.
Yeah, constant. I want to go to both of you. We have time goes so fast, and I want to get in one or two more things here. Right now, let's go back to Charlottesville, Virginia, that Unite the Right rally in August 12, 2017. They were chanting, "Jews will not replace us." It seems to me to be the theme of the white supremacist who Donald Trump is pandering to or promoting or catalyzing, that this whole idea is if Jews or Muslims or Latinos or African Americans grow in number, it is, quote, replacing us, meaning white people, and that make America great again means it's we're going back where America, white America is completely dominant and that domination is secure. Now, in, according to the Census Bureau, defines white people, by the way, I did not know this, as having origins in any of the original peoples of Europe, the Middle East, or North Africa. I mean, this whole categorization of white is just crazy. But the non-Hispanic whites, according to the Census Bureau, make up 62.6% of the country's population. There's speculation now that as demographic and birth rate and death rate trends continue, that by the year 2045, non-Hispanic whites will no longer be 50% of the population. This is what Donald Trump is playing to. Is that
this is what everybody's so panicked about.
Yeah, like that Latinos and African-Americans and people from the Middle East, the so-called melting pot will really be a melting pot.
Oh, my God.
And if white people are no longer the absolute majority, 50% plus one, you know, the sky will fall and the great wondrous achievements of whiteness will be stripped bare from the country. Again, most of the white people don't make any money. You know, most of the families who are white, working class folks, like 90% of the people in this country have an average family income of $30,047, just above poverty. But here's this appeal to go beyond over class and appeal to this base racism. And that's what it's all about. But ultimately, Juan Jose and Isabel will just have you both answer briefly. These demographic trends are irreversible. There's nothing to fear by the irreversibility of the trends. What America really needs is not to have it be enshrined as a white country, but finally to have a country with justice. Go ahead, Juan Jose.
Well, the rhetoric in terms of the immigration experience in the U.S. has been and continues to be, at least in a significant portion of the U.S. population, that what's made America great is its incredible ability to incorporate into its mainstream wave after wave of immigrants that have come and built this country. Now, the problem that we have now is that that narrative is not being extended to the non-white immigrant population that's come into the country primarily from Mexico and the rest of Latin America. But the fact remains, as you said, Brian, that the demographic trends are irreversible, and no matter what Donald Trump does, you can't stop the rain from coming down.
Exactly. Isabel, we'll give you the last word, 45 seconds.
Yes, I agree. It's irreversible. However, they'd like to institute a system of apartheid so that we do not have power. And many of us have given in to all of this for fear and lack of understanding of history. I'm telling you, if people knew the history of immigration, we would not be afraid, right? And people don't even know that where I live here used to be Mexico. I'm telling you, people move here from the Midwest or other places and they have no idea. So we must understand that we have to hug each other, that what makes our country great is what immigrant waves have brought, what African slaves have done, what women have fought for, what Native Americans continue to fight for. That's what's made America great, and people don't understand that's truly what's given us any true meaning is what these groups have fought for.
Okay, that's the voice of Isabel Garcia. We talked to Isabel from Tucson, Arizona. She's the co-founder of the Coalición de Derechos Humanos, and we're joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today, we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Thank you.
It's good to have you both. I want to start with something that we've touched on a number of times, both with the two of you and then in individual segments here on the show, and that is police spying on legitimate, legal, constitutionally protected protests. There was a ruling in Memphis, Tennessee. A federal judge ruled that Memphis police violated a consent decree after spying on protesters. What they did, and this is infuriating, is it says here that they were spying on protesters through the department's, what it's called, this the political spying program. They set up fake Facebook accounts so they could follow protesters. They befriended them. They had access then to private messages. They carried out what they called political intelligence that was specifically forbidden by this consent decree. And then they targeted things like a black-owned food truck festival, a tree planting ceremony, church services, which just screams unconstitutionality. Paul, start us off. Talk about this a little bit.
Well, I think this goes to like the long history of police surveillance of dissidents in this country. And it goes beyond just surveillance, of course. You know, then there's more active measures where, you know, there people are harassed or falsely arrested, evidence is planted and fabricated, the use of informants. And this has kind of been the playbook of the American police states for at least the last 100 years, going back to World War I and the Palmer raids and, you know, the nascent FBI. And I think that it also goes to show, too, is that, you know, we have a police state that's geared up for a full-blown counterinsurgency, and absent actually having that, they make do with what they have, which is peaceful protesters, people exercising their rights to assembly and to petition the government. And, of course, you know, these are generally people that you know, are disagree with government policies or are critical of the police state or various government policies. And I think that that a big part of this reason that they do this, of course, is to intimidate the citizenry and keep people from participating. I think that, I don't know if anyone else on the show here has been involved in, you know, what's organizing, asking people to sign petitions or, you know, whatever. I've asked people to sign petitions around police brutality or police misconduct or prison abuses, and then I've had lots of people tell me, "Oh, I don't want my name on a government list.
Right?
I don't want the government to harass me." So, you know, at a basic level, people get it. You know, people are intimidated, people are deterred, and I think it has its desired effect. So, you know, I think that this is, you know, these practices were rampant throughout most of the 20th century. There was some litigation to curb this in the 1970s, mostly as revelations came out from congressional hearings about the FBI and the CIA, their domestic spying programs and their counterintelligence programs, or COINTELPRO, as the FBI called it, which revealed the extent and, you know, the massive levels of surveillance and disruption that, you know, that took place under these agencies for decades. And they entered in some of these cases, they entered into consent decrees. In other cases, federal courts issued injunctions preventing them from doing this. And unfortunately, they've disregarded it in some cases, as they're doing in Memphis.
Kevin, you've covered this kind of thing extensively over the years. How is this different, or is it different from other cases of the police overstepping the bounds of surveillance that you've encountered?
So I think this fits into what we've seen and how, particularly with the Black Lives Matter movement, all of these law enforcement agencies have ramped up their work in order to target and monitor the sort of mobilization that is ongoing by these groups. But then in addition to, you know, it's as we're talking about monitoring black food trucks, monitoring areas of communities where it isn't apparent that protest is happening, what they're doing is they're practicing total information awareness and trying to see where the next pocket of protest or rebellion is going to pop up. So they're guessing perhaps that maybe in these areas that seem innocent to us, there could be something going on that they might want to follow. And so I think it's important to stress that it is a counterinsurgency model. That's the approach that they are going after people with. And it's even remarkable because there isn't that much of an active minority. There isn't that much of a sustained rebellion in this country, honestly. And yet all of these tools are available at the disposal of law enforcement to use. And so they're using them as they've done many times through history. And in fact, this case is in Memphis. So the ACLU has been keen to point out that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was under intense surveillance in the final days of his life. They were monitoring what was going on in Memphis as he came there to show solidarity with the sanitation workers. And so I think another point is that there's a culture nationally, and it's filtered down across the country in different jurisdictions. You do see local law enforcement practicing in this manner, but it flows down, I believe, from the FBI as well, in the way that they're willing to tolerate this targeting of groups. And I really think we should single out Robert Mueller and his tenure when he was there, and he got an extension, and he was there for basically a decade, serving extraordinary long time as the FBI director. And there were consistent allegations against the FBI for spying on political activists. If you go back to 2006, after the Iraq War, there were major cases involving the Thomas Merton Center for Peace and Justice in Pittsburgh, and how they were under surveillance during their anti-war protests. There were people who were swept up. And you've got international solidarity activists throughout the country who have been targeted with alleged material support for terrorism investigations, with clouds hanging over their heads. So this is an apparatus that is federal as well as state and local.
John Kiriakou, you know, this is sadly routine. It's illegal. It's unconstitutional. It's a violation of the First Amendment right to be able to speak out, to redress grievances in any way is, you know, peaceful, using peaceful means, and to show how routine it is. I was personally the target of an FBI probe ordered by an interagency task force led by, I believe, Oliver North. And the reason for the investigation, which the Center for Investigative Reporting brought out in the mid-1980s, I was the spokesperson for the second Ronald Reagan inaugural protest. And that protest was actually canceled because it was too cold.
It was too cold. I remember that.
But we had the protest anyway. It was we took over the bleachers. Nobody else was using them.
Yet he took the oath of office indoors. It was so cold.
Yeah. So because the Washington, we had a press conference before the inauguration and the counter-inaugural protest. And so my picture was in the Washington Post because I was the spokesperson. So apparently Oliver North, that lunatic in the National Security Council, as part of an interagency task force, ordered an investigation of me and all of the other people who were involved in that protest, so that the Center for Investigative Reporting pointed out that the FBI was actually coordinating, watching the buses that came from cities all over the country bringing protesters to Washington for this peaceful protest, for the counter-inauguration. The protest went on for months and months, and actually the reason the Center for Investigative Reporting found out about it was that the FBI agents who were following me, who were on my watch, which I was completely unaware of at the time, were reporting. I think it was because they were so bored because there was such an uninteresting target. They were reported that this was a violation of the FBI reform provisions following the church hearings in the late 1970s or mid-1970s. So they were protesting and saying this is a violation, and that's why it came out in a public records request. At the same time, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, CISPIS.
I remember them.
They had massive FBI probes conducted against them. This was the early 1980s, again, because they were promoting an agenda of solidarity with the people of El Salvador, meaning self-determination for them, and for the United States government to stop funding the dictatorship there or to stop funding covert operations against people who then were part of the FMLN and now are part of the Salvadoran government. Again, this stretches back, Paul, just to go back to you, It's not just the right now, and it's not even just the 1980s, which is what I'm talking about. We can go back to the Palmer raids, mm-hmm. where J. Edgar Hoover got his start in 1917. I mean, as you said, they're constantly on the lookout for and primed to respond to what they consider to be the possibility of insurgency. But short of insurgency, any old protest or any old protesters or dissent will do. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, part of this, I think, is the bureaucratic imperative to justify their jobs. So, you know, so I think that's, you know, they'll spy on whatever they have to spy on. But again, I think that one of the bigger roles that they have, which I think they succeed in, is discouraging people from participating in the political process.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons we kind of downplay it, because we, meaning political activists and organizers, we don't want people to get scared. Maybe the FBI, Kevin, is perfectly happy with people learning, hey, yeah, guess what? If you come out and protest, we're gonna watch you. We're going to know what you did. Certainly, we could see that from the Occupy movement. That's precisely what they did. And when it came out, they weren't too embarrassed.
Well, yes. And to add to what Paul's saying, you know, part of putting up barricades is the intent to discourage. It's also meant to create a scene and make it seem like, you know, you're not supposed to be assembling at all. And it really is an intent to make sure that maybe you reconsider whether putting out some kind of message, but also things that people would be surprised to know our government had any interest in. You know, this particular thing involving the consent decree, why the outcome happened, you know, one of the things going on was that there's monitoring of what people are reading and liking on Facebook.
Yeah.
So it's like someone saying, I'm reading this book, and it was a book by Saul Alinsky, which is so outdated in theory. I mean, to me, I'm not really sure that most people who are organizing in Black Lives Matter have any interest in that. I think that, like, the government should get up to date on what kinds of activist works are being read by people. But this was going on, and they're documenting who's liking. I mean, apparently this also extends to people's family members. It isn't just the activists or the people engaged in political expression. It documents that there was spying on the spouse of one of these individuals.
We're speaking with Kevin Gustala and Paul Wright in this weekly segment here at Loud and Clear called Criminal Injustice, where we take a look at all of the egregious conduct of the courts, the judges, the prosecutors, the police. Again, Paul Wright, back to you. You know, the Occupy movement, which spread like wildfire all over the country starting in September 2011, people spontaneously, I'd say probably in every state, in many, many cities in most states, set up Occupy encampments. And that's where we sort of invented the slogan, "We are the 99%, which brought a new sort of consciousness and concept to grassroots organizing in Washington. That protest was the target of a coordinated crackdown by the FBI, other law enforcement, local police departments, local and national corporations, all working together through the fusion centers, which were created after 9/11 with the idea that they would help prevent another terrorist attack. But these fusion centers were coordinating this massive surveillance and then this massive crackdown on this peaceful movement. Paul, you know the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. They did a public records request, and they found that in every city and town, these anti-terrorism authorities and anti-terrorism monies, meaning budgeted monies for the struggle against terrorism, were being used to snoop, snitch, spy on, surveil every possible aspect of the Occupy movement, down to, like, in Boston, where it was complete, where they said, at 11 a.m., I can remember some of these documents, I'm sort of paraphrasing, but at 11 a.m., 23 people had liked a Noam Chomsky lecture that was going to be at the Commons. And at 3 p.m., the next report updates, well, now it's 44 people have liked it or are interested in going. I mean, it was down to that level of sort of microscopic surveillance of everything, including social media. Go ahead.
And I would say that they would deem this to be a huge success, is the fact that, and I think one of the things that we overlook is, I think, the fact that, you know, if you ask most people, you know, what are big police states or surveillance states in history, I think people might say, well, you know, Nazi Germany, East Germany, or Stalin's Russia and stuff like that. But, you know, we have degrees of surveillance that police states in the past have only dreamed of, you know, where they can literally get into, you know, literally everything you're reading, every event you go to. Our cell phones act as basically de facto tracking devices. You know, so it's one of those things that, you know, we live in kind of an age of unparalleled surveillance. And, you know, so that's, you know, we still have that. And I think that it really does impact, I think, a lot of political participation. I think that, you know, when you see, you know, when you see upsurges in, you know, protests, whether it's the Occupy movement or whatever, as people are increasingly sick and tired and fed up with the status quo, you know, our ruling class and their police agencies kind of view this as, you know, is this the beginnings of regime change? Is this going to be a color revolution in the United States? And I think that's one of those things where everyone, the real role of the police is not to protect people, is not to protect our lives and safety, it's to maintain the status quo. And I think that that's what the political surveillance of dissidents, real and potential, amply illustrates. You know, because you think about all the police resources that are being used to surveil protesters, and you think, okay, how many unsolved murders and rapes are there in our community? Well, at the end of the day, that's not really the police's function. Their function is to maintain the political status quo, and they are pretty adept at doing that, and even in the absence of resistance, they'll still keep doing it.
Kevin Gostala, before John takes us to another story, I want to just finish out with this issue of surveillance and political dissent. It turns out that, as happens frequently, while the U.S. is engaged in wars abroad, the technologies of wars abroad migrate back home, and they're used against political dissent and people engaging in First Amendment. Here's an article from a media site called Tech Dirt. A Defense Department spied on social media left all its collected data exposed to anyone. There are two big WTFs in this story. First, the Defense Department Central Command, that's CENTCOM for the Middle East, was collecting tons of data on social media posts. And then the bigger one, they somehow left all the data they collected open on an Amazon AWS server. That's Amazon Web Services. This was discovered, as so many examples of careless data exposure on Amazon servers, by Chris Vickery and UpGuard, who have their own post. But it turns out CENTCOM, the Pentagon, and probably, I would guess, the CIA, is constantly using social media, not simply to track people on the battlefield, but also people who may have ideas that are contrarian to what American goals are in any particular region. In other words, there's a kind of seamlessness here about surveillance between U.S. international or foreign policy and military policy and what's going on the home front.
Well, yeah, and absolutely. I mean, I think this is part of a trend of getting around certain norms that are supposed to be in place when it comes to domestic spying. We know that those have been there to some extent ever since the 1970s, when there was all the uproar and the Church Committee. But we've seen that the CIA will maneuver through the NYPD in order to have mass surveillance of Muslim student union groups, of people who are involved in political protest in New York and the areas in and around there. We've seen, as a result of carelessness, or you call it stupid evil, however you want to describe it, that they don't take care of their data or what they're doing. And so they end up posting and revealing that they had been monitoring certain pages of activist groups. This happened out in Boston with a police agency. We've seen with the Pentagon that not only would we have online spying, but that in the counterinsurgency stance that they take, the hardware from these wars come back, that the law enforcement agencies have this hardware deployed, as we saw very vividly in Ferguson. And I think that the point I would end on is that the intent is to send a message that it is not going to be worth it for you to protest. And that is because they know deep down that it is the only thing that has ever changed anything in this country, that people sustained protest is the only thing that has ever affected any kinds of changes. And so far this year, we've seen people who are protesting in unions and other arenas achieve small gains. We've seen gains from teachers' unions from protesting. We've seen small gains achieved by workers in Amazon forcing a raise in their wage. They know that they have to stamp this out by monitoring it closely.
We are speaking with Kevin Gastala. Kevin is a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. He joins us from Chicago. And we're also speaking with Paul Wright from Lake Worth, Florida. Paul is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. I want to change topics, guys, and start with you, Paul. And this is about what a judge is calling deliberate indifference of mental health care for prisoners in Illinois. Now, this doesn't necessarily need to be relegated just to Illinois. Mississippi and Louisiana are worse. North Carolina is worse when it comes to mental health care.
But they're all bad.
They're all terrible. But things have gotten so bad in Illinois that a judge felt that he had to intervene on behalf of 12,000 prisoners with mental illness whose constitutional rights are being violated. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so basically this is kind of like the latest installment, so to speak, of horrific medical care, mental health care for prisoners in Illinois, because the Uptown People's Law Center in Illinois, they filed suit against the Illinois DOC previously, and in 2016 they entered into a settlement agreement where the prison officials agreed that they would improve mental health care for prisoners. And I think to put this into context, depending on the state, anywhere between 40-60% of the prisoners people in prison are classified as seriously mentally ill. And by seriously mentally ill, this means they've got some serious mental problems. This isn't just, hey, they've got some issues or whatever. But they have serious mental health issues that require treatment. So, and one of the problems that also comes up is that prison officials are generally poorly geared to provide mental health care treatment or medical treatment in general. So their solution to people with mental illness in prison is often to lock them up in solitary confinement. And of course, we know from 200 years of doing this that putting people in solitary confinement that are mentally ill already just exacerbates their mental illness and makes their mental illness not just worse, but a lot worse. And so the lawsuit originally had been designed to stop some of that, and the Department of Corrections had agreed to curtail these practices and improve mental health care in 2016, but not surprisingly, as is often the case in this type of prison reform litigation, instead, they have not done it. And so the plaintiffs went back to court, and the court found that indeed the Illinois DOC was not complying with the terms of the settlement, and mental health care treatment for mentally ill prisoners remained abysmal, including specifically placing mentally ill prisoners in solitary confinement, which we know worsens the mental health of people who are already mentally ill.
Yeah, you know, I remember being struck, even in a low security prison, by how many people were genuinely mentally ill. I was even more struck by the fact that there was no treatment for these people other than a pill in what we called zombie pill line, because these pills, whatever they were, just turned you into a zombie so you didn't make trouble for the cops. And then at the same time, they would be thrown into solitary for little or no reason, where they become even crazier than they otherwise would have been. And as you pointed out at the very start of this, Paul, this happens in every state across the country. It happens in the federal system. And indeed, the California state prison system has more mentally ill patients than the mental health system does, the state mental health system. So it's only getting worse.
Well, I was going to say, this has to do with more of the criminalization of mental illness. That, and the other thing, too, is not like our mental health care system before it was, quote, reformed, which I'd say is more like just downsized out of existence for the most part. It's not like it was that great. I mean, there's plenty of exposés and documentaries and investigative reports done about the horrific treatment of mentally ill people in American psychiatric institutions for much of American history. And so we kind of had the deinstitutionalization of people who are mentally ill, but what happened is they just got basically reinstitutionalized as criminals. And instead of people saying, oh, you know, someone's mentally ill, they need to get mental health treatment. Instead, they get incarcerated for either crimes of poverty or homelessness or just because of the factor of their mental illness, and then they wind up in prison. And, you know, it's interesting because I think that this is something that just has such a huge impact on everyone's lives in this country, because every time I hear about another school shooting or some type of mass shooting, the first question I have is, you know, how mentally ill was the person doing it? And then maybe if we had a public mental health care system in this country, maybe we'd all be a lot safer and people would get help that they need before they go on a shooting rampage and kill a bunch of people.
Absolutely true. Well, we are starting to run short of time, so I'm going to go on to the next topic. It's the issue of whistleblowers. Kevin, you've probably covered whistleblower issues more than any journalist I've ever encountered. This one has to do with a prison psychiatrist who says that her whistleblowing cost her job. She was a prison psychiatrist, and after she blew the whistle on care that was so inadequate that it contributed to 3 inmate suicides, her computer access and password were disabled, her state-issued cell phone was disconnected, and she was transferred to the mail room, where instead of being a psychiatrist, she was instructed just to go through inmate mail to look for porn. She was finally forced out of the job. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and apparently it was traumatizing for her to have to pull these pornographic photos out on a daily basis. She seems to have nightmares about working in this mailroom.
She went on stress leave because of it.
I think what's remarkable here is that you are now seeing, we don't have time to get into it, but there are systemic problems that are coming out publicly that the CDCR is actually dealing with related to the very issues in which she allegedly lost her job for. And so, you know, now I think this is part of why she's going public with this story and really letting people know that she was retaliated against, because, you know, it had to do with inadequate care, the fact that medical records aren't being kept properly, that training was poor, the state licenses weren't being done correctly, and that certain actions of the staff were actually contributing to deaths. And so she did what any person with a legitimate soul or any sort of morality would do, even though you're in a situation where you're not actually supposed to adhere to your moral values because it expects you to operate in a certain way. And she decided to challenge the repeated violations. And then for that, because she was trying to actually provide health care or make sure that the system provide for some kind of care, a minimal level of care, then she wound up without her job.
We have about a minute left, Paul. Why don't you take us out?
Yeah, I just want to say that one of the things that we see as far as the role of whistleblowers in the prison system in general and law enforcement in general is that so much of the abuse that's come to light, which really isn't a lot compared to what's actually going on, is that, you know, it comes around because people speak out. All the so-called checks and balances of audits and inspections and inspector generals and stuff like that, they rarely uncover the stuff. Usually the stuff that's been coming out, you know, like the prison psychiatrist, like Dr. Anand, is coming out. This in the context, this is after 20 years of litigation in California. Their medical system is in federal receivership. It's under intensive court scrutiny, yet it still takes an insider to blow the whistle and say, hey, they're subverting the court process. They're fabricating a report showing that mental health care is great when in fact it isn't. So I think that's one of the things that I think one of the roles of whistleblowers play, I think, is illustrating the failures of the so-called official means of measuring progress and measuring the performance of our government agencies.
There it is. We will leave it there. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. Kevin's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.